From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. She dumped me. Three simple words published in the New York Times in 2004 that launched a cultural force, the Modern Love Column, one of the paper's consistently most popular features for the past 15 years. Yes, Modern Love is a podcast, too. Hosted by yours truly once a week. And as far as that 15-year-old essay from Steve Friedman on post-breakup friendship goes, well, I'll let Emmy-winning actor Tony Hale, who you probably know as Gary Walsh from HBO's Veep or Buster Bluth from Arrested Development, I'll let Tony take it from here.
There's no villain here. There is no green-eyed, wasp-waisted, pillow-breasted, sneering queen-of-the-damn villain who dumped me so swiftly and with such imperious, frigid beauty that I experienced chest pains and shortness of breath.
That's Tony Hale from a recent Modern Love the Podcast episode. But what else have we learned about love in America in the past 15 years? Modern Love the Column has become a kind of long-term, slow-motion reflection of American social norms about how attitudes are changing on everything from adoption to LGBTQ relationships to how technology is having an impact on intimacy. So this hour on Point, Modern Love on Valentine's Day and your stories of love, loss, and redemption. And you can join us. What is your modern love story? Do you read the column in the New York Times? Do you have a favorite? Why do the essays resonate with you? And more broadly, how have American attitudes about love changed in the past decade and a half? How have your attitudes changed? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us now from San Francisco, California, is Daniel Jones. He is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and he's the founding editor as well. He's been with the column for its entire 15 years. Dan is also author of the 2014 book titled Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Dan Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. It's good to hear your voice.
It's so great to talk to you. This world's colliding, right?
I know, exactly.
it's so great. So, you know what? Meeting you and getting to know you through the Modern Love podcast has been a great pleasure over the past couple of years. But I want to start by asking you a question I've always wanted to ask you, Dan. How do you feel all these years later being the guy who edits the column, one of the most popular features in one of the most important papers in the United States? Because I imagine, like, every once in a while, the New York Times will, like, I don't know, put out a 40,000-word massive investigation about, say, the president's family's tax returns. And then there comes the Modern Love column on Sunday just blowing up the most read list. I mean, do people kind of shoot you a look in the New York Times newsroom? Like, how do you do that?
Well, I don't know if I displaced that many stories, but it has a consistent readership. And, for me, it's just been sort of it's been a ton of work, but really satisfying work. It's sort of the idea that do something, to the best of your ability. And if you like it and you really work hard at it, maybe other people will like it too. And at least that's been true so far.
Yeah, more than just maybe other people will like it too. Lots of people like it. So tell us the sort of the founding story of the Modern Love column. How did it come about?
It was partly had to do with the fact that I was unemployed at the time. but my wife, Kathy Hanauer, and I are both writers and editors, and we had done companion anthologies about marriage that were essay collections. And hers was called The Bitch in the House, and mine was called The Bastard on the Couch. And they got a lot of attention, and the Styles editor at the time, a guy named Trip Gabriel, took notice and decided that he wanted to have that kind of material in the paper. And we actually started the job as a married couple. That lasted about 3 months before the column even launched, and Kathy backed out. She was working on a book, and it was really a one-person job. And I had nothing else on my plate, so I took it over, never expecting it to last more than a year or two. My life has sort of been happily hijacked by the Modern Love column in the New York Times.
Yeah. And what were those first, earliest essays about? Well, what were people sending you? What stories were they sending you back in 2004?
You know, what I tried to publish was just what really moved me.
Yeah.
And the more powerful, I remember the first one that really blasted through was called The Chickens in the Oven and My Husband's Out the Door. And it was a piece about divorce that just really was so penetrating and honest, and where this woman was totally shocked to sort of discover a kind of secret life of her husband. And they got divorced within a very short amount of time. And she just wrote really movingly about that. And I think it wasn't the kind of material that people were used to seeing in the Times, this first-person confessional kind of essay about the deepest forces that shape our lives.
Yeah. So tell me more about that, because I'm consistently amazed by how vulnerable people are willing to make themselves in this column. You know, the level of detail about some of the most difficult or even euphoric moments in their lives. Like, are you surprised by how much people are willing to talk about through you in the column?
Yeah, I consistently am. I think it was different at the beginning because there wasn't a track record mm-hmm. for that, and there wasn't a model for that. Now it's more like you're joining the ranks of the 600, 700 people who have gone before you. It's understood what it is, but one thing that was important to me was creating this sort of community of trust and being a person who would take care, you know, sort of hold these writers' hands in a lot of cases, let them know what to expect so that there weren't surprises, let them know that if they're writing about a controversial subject, the people who get upset by that are the ones who will respond more than the people who appreciate it. So it's just it's sort of a community of trust where people feel like they can take that leap.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about some recent essays that really exemplify that community of trust here. You can hear me shifting my papers around because all of a sudden I've lost what I need. But anyway, I wanted to talk about the essays from Amy Krauss Rosenthal, first mm-hmm. of all, and her husband, Jason Rosenthal. Can you just remind us who Amy was and what she wrote about?
Yeah, so this was last year. Wait, was it last? I'm losing track of the timing.
Yeah, it was 2017. She died in 2017, right?
2017.
Yeah.
And she is a children's book author and a memoirist, and had written a lot of books and really had a following. And was dying of ovarian cancer, I believe it was ovarian cancer, and wrote an essay for Modern Love that was about sort of pitching her husband. It was like a dating profile for her husband, who was about to be, you know, put on the market. In a sense, it was to really state it baldly, and everything sort of needs an angle. And mm. I get so many stories about death because that's a powerful force in people's lives when you lose a loved one. So a lot of people want to write about it, and we can't publish that much of it. And Amy took this angle that she was going to sort of market her husband. That was the conceit, but actually the essay was really a love letter to him, talking about how, you know, their lives together and how much she was going to miss it, but also wanting to set him free in a sense.
Well, you know, those pair of essays we did turn into or use them for the Modern Love the podcast. So I want to give people a sense of what Amy said. We had Deborah Winger read Amy Krauss Rosenthal's essay, and as we mentioned, Amy died in 2017, just a couple of days after her essay was published. So here's an excerpt.
I want more time with Jason. I want more time with my children. I want more time sipping martinis at the Green Mill Jazz Club on Thursday nights. But that is not going to happen. I probably have only a few days left being a person on this planet. So why am I doing this? I am wrapping this up on Valentine's Day and the most genuine, non-vase-oriented gift I can hope for is that the right person reads this, finds Jason, and another love story begins. I'll leave this intentional empty space ahead as a way of giving you two the fresh start you deserve.
That's Deborah Winger reading Amy Krauss Rosenthal's essay. You know, Jason, her husband, wrote a response essay. We'll hear a little bit from the podcast version of that in just a moment. But Dan, what was the reaction to Amy's essay when it was published in the New York Times? Like, I think I heard everyone around me cry when we read it.
Yeah, it was really profound and immediate. You know, you can see some of these essays just take off like wildfire. And hers, you know, it just made people want to talk about it and want to tweet about it and want to post about it. And so it just sort of raced around the world and had, you know, millions of people had read it within 24 hours. Kind of blew me away.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about the reaction that people feel when they read both the Modern Love column in the New York Times and perhaps even listen to the podcast that's hosted by yours truly. But we are talking about love in America in 2019 and what's changed about our social attitudes or our intimacy in the past 15 years. Dan Jones joins us. He's the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. And we're going to take a quick break here with Alabama Shakes and I Found You from their 2012 debut album, Boys and Girls. This is On Point.
I remember all them lonely days I traveled out on my own. Then you brought me everything. You made my house a home. But if it's not the real deal, I don't know it. Cause it so does feel, and I think it so does show.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Daniel Jones. He's the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and also author of Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Modern Love, the column, has been a regular feature of the New York Times for the past 15 years, a very popular feature in the Times. It's also, for the past several years, been a podcast, which I am fortunate enough to host. The world's colliding here. But really what we're talking about is how we think about love, how we write about love, what the evolution of the Modern Love column tells us about America's social attitudes about relationships. So we want to know what you think on this Valentine's Day about how you think Americans engage with love has changed in the past 15, 20 years. Find us online at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Dan, someone just sent us a tweet. Xavier says, the Modern Love podcast constantly shows me that my experiences in love are less exciting than I once thought. And thank goodness for that. Xavier, I don't know. Like, one of the lessons that I get from the column in the podcast is how vulnerable and fragile we all are, because that's every week. I just think there's so many stories about how life can change in an instant. Dan, I mean, are you surprised by how many people want to talk to you about the fragility of their existences?
Yeah, and everybody has a story. It's really, the distinction is who can tell it and who can't. I mean, everybody is living through these things and these difficulties, and that's part of why these stories resonate. Is you know, they're told by someone who has been able to figure out how to sort of combine their vulnerability with intelligence, and and tell it in a way and describe it or come to a conclusion that you know, otherwise hasn't been reached, or that gives an insight into, you know, a way to think through these difficulties in relationships, because relationships, for all the, you know, how great they are difficult. You know, they're difficult for everybody.
Right. You know, so here's the biggest difference between live radio and a podcast, and that is I am always in live radio, like, it just happens and I can't fix it. And my plan in the previous segment was to play that excerpt from Amy Krauss Rosenthal's essay back to back with her husband's response. Mm-hmm. I screwed that up and we had to take a break. But just to remind folks, you know, two of our most recent favorite essays were, one, Amy Krauss Rosenthal's essay that she wrote just about 10 days before she died, basically introducing her husband to the world and saying, hey, here's a great guy you might want to consider. The headline of that story was, "You May Want to Marry My Husband." And we played actress Deborah Winger reading an excerpt of that essay that appeared in the podcast. As we mentioned, Jason Rosenthal did write a follow-up essay, which was published last June, right, Dan? About what
her Father's Day.
Yeah, and what Amy's essay meant to him. So we had, for the podcast, we had actor Andre Holland read this essay. It was titled, "My Wife Said You May Want to Marry Me."
I couldn't digest any of these messages at the time, but I've since found solace and even laughter in many of them. One thing I've come to understand, though, is what a gift Amy gave me by emphasizing that I had a long life to fill with joy, happiness, and love. Her edict to fill my own empty space with a new story has given me permission to make the most out of my remaining time on this planet. If I can convey a message I've learned from this bestowal, it would be this. Talk with your mate, your children, and other loved ones about what you want for them when you are gone. By doing this, you give them liberty to live a full life and eventually find meaning again. There will be so much pain, and they will think of you daily. But they will carry on and make a new future, knowing you gave them permission and even encouragement to do so."
That's Andre Holland reading Jason Rosenthal's essay, "My Wife Said You May Want to Marry Me," which originally appeared in the Modern Love column for the New York Times. Dan...
That hits me hard, you know, knowing the story so well, you know, even knowing the story so well, just...
How do you do that? I mean, you have, how many submissions have you received over the past 15 years?
I don't know. 90,000.
90,000. I mean, how do you do this? How do you receive? So that's hundreds a day. All these essays.
It's not hundreds a day, but it probably adds up to, like, neither one of us are good at math, I guess. It's probably closer to, like, 200 a week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay, nevertheless.
That's what we're publishing. We're publishing, like, 1 in 200.
200 yeah. submissions a week of people just, like, opening up their hearts to you. How do you deal with that? How do you wade through it all?
I mean, you get very fast at making decisions. You also get decision fatigue. You get bad eyesight and dry eyes and occasional headaches. But it's a little bit like sort of being in an avalanche constantly and trying to sort of get your bearings, because this stuff pours in. And now we've even opened the floodgates more, because we have a new feature called Tiny Love Stories, which are little 100-word love stories that readers send in with a picture. And we've already gotten 10,000 of those in just a few months.
Wow.
So it's little glimpses with visuals of people's lives and love stories and pains and all of that. That's even more of an avalanche. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you put your professional hat on and you are looking for a spark, and you're looking for intelligence and honesty and humility. And you just get good over the years at being able to zero in on that.
Yeah. You know, that is Dan Jones, the editor, speaking. Because, of course, I wanted to hear you say, well, I engage with all these essays and I try to find out what I can draw from them and what stories haven't been told. But no, you right, folks, if you want to submit to the New York Times for Modern Love, you got to nail it in the first sentence is what Dan is telling you. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Nick, you're on the air.
Oh, geez, here we go. I've been married for like 20 years. And our relationship got kind of stale until I died like 2 years ago. I died for like 20 minutes. And, you know, I didn't realize how much I like counted on my wife. I'm not an emotional guy, so I don't really tell her how I feel or anything. So, but yeah, if I didn't have her, I'd be lost. And like I said, dying for that 20 minutes kind of definitely showed, you know, how important she really was to me because she stood by me and stuff.
Wait. So Nick, can I just somebody see, you say you died for 20 minutes? Like what were you, you had heart surgery? What happened?
I was having carpal tunnel surgery, not a major surgery or anything, but I didn't realize I had heart disease, and I had a 90% blockage in my heart, and so then I died on the table for 20 minutes, and she stood by me. I've had a lot of health problems now because of the heart disease. Like, I'm the first person in Wisconsin to get dissolvable stents and stuff, and she stood by me all that time, and like I said, I'm not a big person to say that I love her all the time and stuff, so... I'm not the emotional person. But after I get off the phone, I'll definitely be ordering flowers because, you know, yeah.
Wow. Well, Nick, thank you for your call. Dan, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, Nick saying that he confronted his mortality in the most concrete way. Do you get a lot of stories about that, about how people's entire lives are changed when they have these brushes with death and they really reconsider every relationship in their lives, but most strongly their most intimate ones.
Yeah, well, I hear a lot. One of the most common kinds of stories we get is the midlife marriage doldrums. You know, and what does it take to shock you out of that, to wake you up, to make you appreciate things? You know, we're so distracted these days by, you know, social media and by politics and all of that. And you just start to feel like you're sleepwalking through your relationships after a while. And yeah, I mean, it's cliche, but it's true that brushes with mortality jolt the system and let you know what's important and who's there for you and how crucial that is.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about how over these past 15 years, whether you wanted to or not, Dan, you've learned a lot about how Americans' views or attitudes or feelings about relationships and love have kind of changed and evolved. I mean, first of all, I think I know you've said this before, but one of the major sort of main evolutions that you've seen through the column matches the change in American attitudes about LGBTQ relationships. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you've seen that in Modern Love?
Yeah, it's. I guess it's tracked sort of the social changes in that regard. I mean, when the column started, gay marriage was not legal anywhere, I don't think. And when gay marriage first became legal, I believe in Massachusetts first, we started running columns about that. It became legal in New York, and I remember we ran a column about that. And the way that those social changes sort of create a freedom for these kinds of couples then quickly turns into a consequence as well, because if gay couples can get married, then gay couples can get divorced, and then suddenly we're confronted with gay divorce stories. And the same thing that's happened with transgender couples dealing with that, or individuals dealing with that, and gender identity and surgery. Can relationships endure that? That's a subject that I don't believe we got a single essay about for years. Uh-huh. And we're talking about a big pool of essays. No one was willing to touch it. And then we ran one, and then we ran another that was about a couple where the husband was was transitioning to a woman, and was this relationship going to survive that? And it was the day of facial feminization surgery, of taking him to the hospital and bringing her home. She changed pronouns from the way to the hospital to the way home. It was such a powerful and moving piece, and really brought readers into the humanity of this. It's not an abstract, strange thing. It's a human thing, and it's tender moments, and it's anguish. And this couple got through that and are still together today. But it was I love those kinds of windows into worlds.
Well, you know, that particular essay you're reminding me of, one of the reasons why I loved it and so many others is that, I don't know, I feel like so much in life right now is shot through with politics, right? And tension and conflict. But these essays are sort of drained of all that. And what we're left with are the real lives of people, like not as advocates living with politics, but just like, here's what it's really like to live in this moment. And I feel more connected to them that way than I ever do in almost any other forum that I hear or read these stories.
I think of them as offerings in a way. You know, it's a good word for what these are because, you know, there was an essay that I loved by a young writer named Heather Bertman that was called My Body Doesn't Belong to You. And it was, this was before Me Too. This was several years ago. And it was about a woman who was talking about in childhood how she was free. She wasn't really coveted by men. And then when her body developed, she entered this world that so many women enter, where you feel like other people, through their words, through their gestures and grabs or whatever, are sort of taking ownership of your body. And for her to write about that in a public place that millions of people have access to is an incredibly brave act, but so helpful to all these women who have felt that way. And I just think, like, that is an offering. That is saying, okay, I'm going to take this mantle and run with it at a sort of a cost to my privacy and whatever. But it's generous. It's helpful.
Yeah.
Profoundly helpful.
Yeah. Well, let's very quickly, let's go to the calls. Let's go to Diana, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Diana, we've just got a little bit of time before we have to take a quick break, but go ahead.
Hi. Yes. I've been married 4 times, and I'm now recently engaged to a man who's 40 years younger than me. I am 72 years old, and I am just so happy that I've never given up hope on love. I'm a marriage and family therapist, so I help people with their relationships a lot and to learn how to love in a way. And I've been so blessed. I just want to tell people never to give up on love. It's just awesome. He's actually a French person. He lives in France, and I'm in America. But we travel back and forth. And like I said, we've been together almost a year.
Wow.
Really wonderful.
Well, Diana, congratulations. I'm thinking maybe you ought to submit your story to a certain newspaper based in New York City.
That would be awesome. I don't know how to do that, but I can work on it. Sure.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for your call. Dan, what do you think about Diana's story?
That's unusual. but both the age gap and the number of marriages, but the optimism about it is something that I find kind of infectious and admire. I've heard from a couple of older writers who have described feeling like teenagers again, you know, falling in love at 80, and I never thought I'd feel like a teenager again kind of thing.
Well, we're talking with Daniel Jones. He's editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times on this Valentine's Day, and you can share your love story, whether it be celebratory or maybe tragic as well, and what you think about how your attitudes about love have changed over time. So as we head into the break, this, of course, is Rihanna featuring Calvin Harris with We Found Love, 2011, the album Talk That Talk. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Daniel Jones. He is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and author of Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. And the Modern Love column is frequently one of the most popular pages or sections of the New York Times. And it's also a podcast, and I'm lucky enough to be the host of that podcast. So we're bringing worlds together here, and we want to hear your story on this Valentine's Day of love, or what you've learned about life through your relationships. And Dan, let me share a couple of comments that are coming in here. On our website, someone named Aobin, I hope I'm saying that remotely correctly, but they're writing that in 2005, at the age of 50, my husband died of ALS. He had had it for 4 years, and during those 4 years, he prayed every day for a good and godly man to come after him. Well, one did, and she says she's been remarried for 11 years now. David is amazing, exactly the man she needed after such a loss, and so much fun. Her life has been amazing. So one listener there expressing gratitude for the relationships in her life. And then over on Twitter, D. Kieft Dan is telling us that she loves the podcast and the stories, but she's just grateful that she's found she has a fabulous hubby of 20 years as she sits back and watches her son's dating and modern love struggles in the, quote, modern world. So, Dan, this is something I wanted to talk to you about. In recent times, technology has been a character in a lot of the essays that you've had in the modern love column. What's going on there? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, technology plays so many roles, and especially in helping us find love with dating apps and Tinder, and being able to just communicate with people and have this whole world of people at our disposal. It is as much of a curse as a blessing. I've found I think one constant in love and relationships and trying to find those is how hard it is to be vulnerable with another person. And we will grab at any crutch and any hide behind any curtain we can to try to be able to find love without being vulnerable, some shortcut to the right person. And I think a lot of people view technology as that promise, as that shortcut, as that thing we can hide behind to have a relationship or find a relationship without having to expose ourselves to the possibility of hurt. And so it's multiplied that kind of that kind of fantasy, I guess, and also multiplied the kind of disappointment that that comes with getting deeply connected to someone emotionally online and then finally meeting them in person and finding out the person didn't lie about who they were, but they're a different person in the flesh than online.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Jill, who's calling from Vermilion, South Dakota. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi. With this topic, I am an interpersonal communication teacher and researcher, and I use modern love. I've done two presentations on my analysis of modern love, and I use it in my interpersonal communication classrooms because they're priceless. There's no other way that we have for students to really step into another's experience with the kind of honest and compelling stories that are shared through modern love. So I'm a big fan.
Well, Jill, do you have a particular question? I mean, you've got the man who's the editor of all these columns here with you. Do you have a question for him about how he does it? Or
I'll just take the compliment. That's fine.
One of my observations is that although, I mean, Modern Love, the very title, argues that love changes, I'm always amazed at how our understanding of love doesn't change, that even after reading the experiences, we still have this idea that there's this one special person and we will find them somehow and it will be magic. And we really don't pay much attention to things like timing or coincidence or, you know, the fact that we all marry people who are very, very similar mm-hmm. to us, both in terms of social class and geography. But boy, that Cinderella kind of love story is pretty permanent.
Yeah. Jill, before you go, I just want to ask you, like, do you think that's because that's what we all presume will happen to us or many of us or that's what we want, right? It's the difference between expectation and desire.
Right. Yes, I think we all do really want that because there's such a lovely kind of perfect. I almost didn't have to choose because, you know, love just brought us together.
Yeah.
There's a magic in that and a wonderful, as you said before, a wonderful optimism. Mm.
Well, Jill, thank you for your call. Dan, what do you say?
Well, first of all, I have to say that my father partly grew up in Vermilion, South Dakota. So we have that in common. It's not a big place. There's a lot of fantasy about love, and there's a lot of fantasy about you know, finding the person. And, you know, the idea of love being the thing that brings us together for life and for marriage is a relatively new phenomenon in the history of man. You know, marriage was for practical reasons, political reasons, religious reasons. And now it's about love and the perfect person. And it makes me feel a little sorry for love, honestly. Like, it's a lot of pressure to put on that feeling and on that bond, because people are sort of free agents and they're independent and self-supporting, and we don't need each other in the ways we used to for marriage and relationships. And all the pressure is on that kind of perfection and that kind of feeling, and that crushes a lot of viable relationships that otherwise would have lasted, I think, that fantasy and expectation.
So do you see a lot of people writing with submissions that are about disillusionment then?
Yeah. I mean, I often say that I get two kinds of essays, how do we find love and how do we keep it?
Uh-huh.
And the how do we keep it, that's a lot of material there. Like, how do you stay in that state, or how do you recover that feeling just enough, you know, to make it through the hard times, or sometimes to make it through the good times. You know, sometimes it's the hard times that bring us together. So I don't know what the answer to that is. I do appreciate the same thing that Jill was talking about, that the fundamentals about love don't really change so much.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really master love, which is something I admire about it. Like, you can study it all you want, but, you know, I'm not going to be any better at it than the average person. Even being bathed in it, for the past 15 years every day, it's not a masterable thing,
yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Well, let's go to Billy, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Billy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What prompted me to call was Dan's comment about an earlier caller that said, where he said that people feel like teenagers when they fall back in love at an older age. And my fiance and I, we're actually getting married this afternoon. We dated in college for 2 months, broke up and went our separate ways, and we're totally out of touch until 30 years later, 28 years actually. And we got together on the first date, long distance. We live 300 miles apart. Since that first date, we haven't missed a weekend. We missed 1 weekend in 4 years.
Wow.
So we're always commuting 300 miles a weekend. And as a matter of fact, I'm driving 300 miles to get married down in her town.
Wait, so Billy, you're getting married today?
Yes, I am.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you very much.
So it sounds like you do feel like a teenager all over again.
I still do, even a little over 4 years into it. It feels new every day. And, you know, hopefully we'll find a way, like I said, to keep it going, which is probably the tough part.
We've
both been married a couple of times before.
Well, Billy, thank you. Don't go away just yet, Billy. Dan, you have some advice for Billy as he heads down back to the altar?
I'm bad at advice, but I love the story of the reconnection from 30 years before or whatever. I think those connections that we make when we're teenagers in our early 20s, so often I hear that story of people going through their lives. They marry somebody else. They may marry two other people. But those old bonds and the feeling of trust that you have with someone that you knew in your childhood, that's just such a common story. But it's a relatively new story because we're able to find those people these days so easily and get in touch with them in a way that we didn't used to be able to, you know. So that's actually a common story and a common success story that I hear.
Yeah. Well, Billy, our heartiest congratulations to you and your fiancé. So stay on the road. Be safe. You've got an important appointment to make. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Dean, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have an associate's in psychology, and one of the things that I learned was that too much choice can be overwhelming. And so I wondered if that can apply to the modern era of dating using apps like Tinder, where you have possibly hundreds of thousands of matches where if the choice is overwhelming, it can almost lead to a choice paralysis. And for sake of time, I can take my answer off the air. Thank you guys again.
Thank you, Dean. I mean, Dan, you must see submissions about this, that like,
yeah,
it's just
absolutely.
Hard. Yeah. Go ahead.
And that's the business that dating apps are in, is trying to figure out a way to get those numbers down, to narrow it down for you, and to take your, you know, sort of preferences to use to narrow it down. And, you know, I am no critic of dating apps. People have found, you know, countless millions of people are finding successful relationships that way and meeting people they never would have met. The downside is the sort of mania that it can produce, especially with apps like Tinder, where you're swiping, and that sort of serotonin rush or whatever that you get each time you see a new face of someone who might want to go out with you. The strange thing about dating apps, like if you walk into a bar, you don't automatically assume that every person there wants to date you. You probably assume the opposite. And when you get onto a dating app, everyone's advertising themselves as wanting to date you. And I think there's sort of a strange inversion there where you have these expectations of like, oh my God, there's like 300,000 people here and they're all saying date me. It's overwhelming and it can lead to this sort of, you know, decision fatigue where you can never commit to one person. Even when you're going out with that person, you know you have a whole pocket full of other people who might be better. And that's tough. That's tough to be patient through that process and really get to know one person.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. It's wonderful to hear these stories. I was going to say that in my experience with my wife, who I love more now, 13 years into marriage, and she seems to feel the same way because she left this incredible message on my way in. Like the lesson that kind of like we've told some younger people, because we're a little bit older, about like what to do to maintain a relationship, she said, once you run into somebody, the idea of commitment and loving first, in a sense, or humbling yourself to the needs of the other person, when you do that kind of thing, sort of like love follows, in a sense. Like my wife and I were never like each other's archetype, like what we expected that we would be with. But the more we sort of humbled ourselves, in a sense, to the other person, and vice versa, like the deeper and the more connected we grew, so that, like, you know, we're both more passionate and in love with each other now than we were on the day of our marriage. And we talk about that. And the kids see it, too. And it's really nice that they see it. So, I mean, it's just a thought out there for permanence, I guess, is you kind of have to put yourself second sometimes.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for your call, actually. And Dan, I love what Nick said about you learn over time that perhaps one of the greatest acts of love is humbling yourself to the other person, not in a self-effacing way or self-damaging way, but giving, essentially. And is that and Nick was obviously, you know, he was perhaps a little – he's obviously older than his kids. So do you see like a difference in terms of how younger and older people are sort of writing about what they feel the core tenets of love are?
I think we each generation thinks they're going to do love better than the previous generation. There's this aspirational quality to it that you look at your parents' relationship or people of that generation and you think, oh, they're stuck in old roles, you know, and we're going to do it better and we're going to master it and we're going to avoid all those mistakes. And then we sort of wander into our own swamp, you know, of trying to do it differently. But I like the optimism about all of that and how people just sort of march into it. I do think there's what Nick was saying about he said we love each other even more than when we got married. There's the wedding is, you know, sort of the high point for of what we celebrate in marriage, and it's always strange to have this thing being like, okay, you've gotten married, but that was the easy part, you know. Maybe we should celebrate 10 years down the road, you know, make a bigger deal of that than the wedding itself.
Yeah. Well, Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and author of Love Illuminated and advisor to the Modern Love podcast. Dan, thank you so much. It's so great to talk to you again over the line. Thanks for being with us on this Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Meghna. It was a great pleasure.
And by the way, folks, I really want you to go to wherever you subscribe your podcast. Be sure you have the On Point podcast in your feed. And the Modern Love podcast as well. And on this Valentine's Day, I just want to say to my three Valentines, I love you very much. We're going to end with Kendrick Lamar and his track Love off his 2017 album, Damn. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. There's nobody, no one to outrun me. So give me a run for my money. It's been bubbly, feeling lovely. Living love.